Welcome to our beautiful church. Whether you are coming to St. Stephen's Green for some time, or you are new or just passing through, and a particular welcome if you're a visitor, of course, and if you're participating later on, participating now on the webcam or watching later on the website. My name is Paul Murray, and I'm a member of the church, and we have a long tradition of encouraging members of the congregation to take a service when the minister isn't available. And today it's my turn. And of course, any views expressed are not those of the church. They're entirely personal. The first thing we do, and it's done in Unitarian churches around the world, is we light a candle. And the candle is a beacon of hope. It's a sign of our search for truth and meaning. And it's our sign of our friendship and communion with each other. And we also think particularly of those who are suffering terribly in the Ukraine-Russian war and in Israel-Palestine, of their relatives, many of them in Ireland, who are acutely worried about family members in their home countries. We come to this church with hope that in the search for truth, or at least some understanding of the world and those we agree with, and of those with whom we disagree, that we'll be open to hear contrary points of view, that we'll understand that there is usually an other side, if not many other sides, to an argument. And we come hoping to understand the opinions of people, particularly those with whom we violently disagree on civil or religious grounds. And we also hope for the grace to be less dismissive or contemptuous of beliefs which to us might appear preposterous. Our first hymn, We Would Be One, number 318. First reader is Trish.
Good morning, everyone. I looked through a couple of books of poetry to try and pick something today. I find that if your friends know that you like poems, you tend to be given gifts of books of poetry, a poem for every day, and I have three or four of these. I actually lighted on a fairly light one, which is Brian Bilson, but he has two poems that I'd like to read. One is the one for today, and the other is one that has been read a couple of times in the church, but I think it actually could do it another reading. First one is for 6th of October. The social media platform Instagram was founded on this day in 2010. I like Instagram. There's lots of great content to be found, and it can provide a pleasant respite from the combative nature of Twitter. Does always make me feel a little amateurish, though, when I see how beautifully others present their poems, freshly whipped out of their Remington typewriters or set against the stunning backdrop of a rippling wheat field. As for thoughts on influencers, I'd be happy to tell you about those over a delicious salted caramel macchiato from the House of Coffee, the brand that never lets you down, just $3.99 if you mention this book at the checkout. That's his introduction. A life of influence. I live a life of influence, of firm and forceful sway. I influence the clothes you wear, your choice of holiday. I recommend the books you read, cosmetics and new tights. I'd recommend you Novichok if the price was right. Retailers hold their breath for me and hope I love their brands, which of course I always will, subject to my demands. I influence the food you eat. I influence your views. I influence my bank account and monetize click-throughs. I've influenced the scientists to change astronomy. The Earth no longer goes round the sun, it orbits around me. A more serious one, it's from the 20th of June, and his introduction to this is, World Refugee Day is observed on this day every year, raising awareness of the plight of the millions of people forced to leave their homelands due to war, conflict, or persecution. I'm saddened by how polarized the debate over the refugee crisis has become in recent times, and in particular, how anyone could look at the kinds of images we see regularly on our television screens or in our social media feeds of refugees drowning as they cross the sea or a mother weeping for her dead child and not respond with compassion. Have patience with this because it has to be read two ways. Refugees, they have no need for our help. So do not tell me those haggard faces could belong to you or me, should life have dealt a different hand. We need to see them for who they really are, chancers and scroungers, layabouts and loungers, with bombs up their sleeves, cutthroats and thieves. They are not welcome here. We should make them go back to where they came from. They cannot share our food, share our homes, share our countries. Instead, let us build a wall to keep them out. It is not okay to say these are people just like us. A place should only belong to those who are born there. Do not be so stupid to think that the world can be looked at another way. Now the poet asks us to read the poet from the bottom, the poem from the bottom upwards. The world can be looked at another way. Do not be so stupid to think that a place should only belong to those who are born there. These are people just like us. It is not okay to say build a wall to keep them out. Instead, let us share our countries, share our homes, share our food. They cannot go back to where they came from. We should make them welcome here. They are not cutthroats and thieves with bombs up their sleeves, layabouts and loungers, chancers and scroungers. We need to see them for who they really are. Should life have dealt a different hand, these haggard faces could belong to you or me. So do not tell me they have no need of our help.
Thank you, Trish. If we could go to the back of our books, please, and we could read the emblem, anthem, really, as to why we are in this church. Love is the doctrine of this church. The quest of truth is its sacrament, and service is its prayer. To dwell together in peace, to seek knowledge and freedom, to serve mankind in fellowship, to the end that all souls shall grow in harmony with the divine, we do with each other and with God. Our second hymn is number 17, which we're probably not familiar with, and it's called Every Night and Every Morn. The story I'm going to tell you now, anyway, is about the Druff family, D-R-U-F-F. And the thing about the Druffs was that they had a number of problems, but one problem they didn't have was that they were not poor. They were, in fact, exceedingly rich. So much so that their car had a special place in Dundrum Shopping Centre. It had to be put out. And they had houses down in Castletown Bear, and they had houses in California, and they had houses everywhere. But they had two particular problems. One was sort of a business problem. And the business problem was that Mr. Druff, and he was a self-made man. You can understand that he didn't go to college or anything like that. And he left school early, but he had made an amazing invention. He had invented a cure for dandruff. And it was, if you excuse, head and shoulders above any other cure for dandruff. But there was one problem which they had, and that was that it only worked with white people. It,
didn't work with people from Africa and Asia. So Mr. Druff, who knew nothing about sort of finding out or researchers or anything like that, he went up to UCD and he went up to the psychology department because he heard they dealt with things about heads. And he was told, no, you go to the dermatology department. And he went over to dermatology. And now, to this day, there are 7 PhD students all studying. It's a world center of excellence in regard to dandruff with people from other countries. Trinity are livid. And then, anyway, the other problem, of course, that was just an aside to explain how rich they were. But the other problem was that they could have Mr. and Mrs. Druff, who met in Zhivago's in Baggot Street many, many, many years ago, they could not have children. And it really upset them. So Mrs. Druff, Concepta, she decided that what they should do was they should try and adopt. And they went up to this place and they were investigated and they were told, that's fine, you can have, and they got a phone call and the phone call said that you can adopt a brother and a sister. Now, as we all know, that's a very hard thing to do. And they drove up anyway to the, they were Catholics, by the way, I hasten to add, which wasn't there. Anyway, they were Catholics and they drove up to this place and the nun met them on the steps. And the nun said, come on in. And she said, we've talked to you and we think you'll be very, very good parents. So they said, she said, the children are called Fortescue and Esmeralda. Now, Concepta and Mr. Duff were not happy with this. They said, first of all, nobody knew how to spell it. And second, they're going to be teased. So what we wanted to call them, because we're going to have a very loving family and there's going to be plenty of cuddles and snuddles, we want to call them Snoodle and Snuggles. Now, the nun was a little bit upset and she said that really it should be a Catholic saint's name. And she was a bit worried because the Reverend Mother was away on a skite to Fatima and she couldn't... get him, you know, she couldn't get permission. But eventually, Dan, Mr. Druff, and Concepta told the nun that the patron saint of brothers and sisters was Saint Snoodle and Saint Snuddles. And she agreed. Finally, she agreed, but she was a very kind nun. And anyway, the nun, they left, they were taken, they were chauffeur driven home, of course. And they were driven home, the two little children, and they grew up a little bit, and they were sent to all the best schools. They went to a famous school called Accumulate Together, which you learned things like polite, meaningless conversation, basics like ballet and skiing, and also personalized shopping and all of these kind of things that you need to know to get on in life. And the other thing they learned, of course, the most important one, was how to get a spouse from the similar social thing that you were on. So like all of these things, the plans of Mr. and Mrs. Duff, they were very loving, very caring. The children each had a separate bathroom. They went to this extraordinary school, Accumulate Together. And after a while, of course, as we all know, children become teenagers. And Mr. and Mrs. Druff began to find that life was changing and that the children were beginning to rebel. They missed the trip to Switzerland. They weren't washing. In fact, their friends in school called them the Whiffies, because they whiffed. And they began to be very impolite in their conversation. So Concepta suggested, they were very worried that what they should do was, of course, what they should go and get advice. Like all good parents, they went off to get advice. And they went off to the kind nun. And the kind nun was very kind. And she suggested that what they should do is take the silver spoon out of their mouths and send them to an ordinary school like Columbus or Alex or one of those kind of schools, which would be much cheaper and, you know, wouldn't have quite the... So anyway, they did that and the children began to improve and they began to, you know, they were still protesting, but they began to wash again and they became quite like most other children. And eventually, anyway, the good news is they found spouses suitable to them. So Snoodle and Snuddles each found a spouse. And the lovely thing about it was that at the very end, at the wedding, the Snoodle and Snuggles were given away by their adoptive parents, two of them, by their birth parents, who they had got to know and love, two of them, and then by the four parents of the spouses that Snoodle and Snuggles had chosen. And to end it happily, to show that life had changed an awful lot, the wedding was done by the kindly nun, because they couldn't get a priest in the south side. And anyway, so the lesson really of this story, children, is that parents, it's a good idea to seek advice, that rearing teenagers is tough stuff, and that, as we all can gather from the story, having riches is not necessarily the key to happiness. Now, the second reading is something that has been read in this church before, and it's from this book by Leslie Weatherhead called The Christian Agnostic. And he quotes his friend Rainer Johnson, and in it he says, "I am not prepared to hand over to any other person, though wise and learned, or to any institution, however ancient or sure of its position, my inalienable right to search for ever-growing and ever-expanding truth. I believe the craving for security in belief is one which arises from within ourselves and can only be met adequately from resources which are within ourselves. It seems to me that it is far more important for a soul in evolution to believe in a few things because it has struggled, thought and suffered to discover and possess them, than it is for it to have a comfortable and orderly faith which it has adopted from any source outside itself. You must choose," he said, "by what you know to be true, and not merely by what you feel to be edifying." That's from the book Christian Agnostic by Leslie Weatherhead. We have a short reflection, which will be concluded with music by Josh. Let us pause for a few minutes and recall those for whom we hold love and affection, those who have gone before us, and those who are still with us. With deep gratitude for all they have brought to our lives.
The title of this address, Honest to God. You'll know the phrase, particularly if you were a former Catholic of a certain age. Honest to God, cross my heart and hope to die, often accompanied by the sign of the crucifix on the speaker's throat. It meant, of course, that God is witness to what has been said, so therefore the truth has been told. And of course, in the Bible, in Matthew and Luke, and elsewhere, Jesus points to the importance of honesty. We are known by our fruit and are warned that dishonesty will always be found out. And in James chapter 5, we are told not to swear, not by heaven or by earth or anything else. All we need to do is to say a simple yes or a simple no. And some of us may recall Honest to God, a book by Bishop Robinson in Britain, which stirred the religious pot, particularly among Anglicans. It discounted traditional views on Christian doctrine. For example, and quite Unitarian indeed, Jesus was said to be fully human, although he shows us God like no one else. And in a pitch for situation ethics, Robinson enjoined that people should live in the spirit with no absolutes but God's love, which will, he said, find its own particular way in every individual situation. More of this a little later. Nearly 30 years ago, some of us may remember, a group of brave and determined British women broke the law. Well, they broke the law according to the authorities, not in their view. They were, in fact, as they saw, upholding the law. But even as we might discuss whether they were or were not lawbreakers, a far more important issue arises. Were they behaving ethically and are morally? And the theme today here is that while we are, I'd suggest, a reasonably law-abiding congregation, is there a danger that we could allow ourselves to be hidebound by law with all the protections that offers for our predominantly middle-class lifestyles, at the expense of behaving ethically? We'll use the word for convenience and interchangeably with morally. Or indeed, are we failing to appreciate those who behave as they see it ethically and contrary to are on the margins of what is legal, even if we would emphatically disagree with their behavior? We could think particularly of the Burke family and the row over the persistent attendance of Enoch at Wilson's Hospital School, contrary to court orders. But back to those brave women. 10 of them planned to disarm a British Aerospace Hawk fighter plane, which was to be sold to Indonesia, then brutally putting down opposition to its occupation in East Timor, now Timor-Leste. The women believed, that in destroying the fighter jet, they were preventing a crime taking place, that British Aerospace was aiding and abetting genocide. The prosecution said that they had damaged property belonging to someone else. What they did was irresponsible, and no law-abiding citizen would do such a thing. Anyway, as you may recall, a jury found them not guilty, much to the disgust of the Daily Telegraph and the right-wing tabloids. So in essence, they were not lawbreakers. But even if the jury had found against them, would they have been behaving ethically? And in moral terms, would that supersede breaches of the law? The women, who took the name plowshares from the biblical phrase, "They shall beat their swords into plowshares and their spears into pruning hooks," insisted that anybody can do a plowshare action. All you need is a hammer and a functioning arm. But of course, you need more. You need courage. As Osho wrote in The Joy of Living Dangerously, you need to have learned over time, as Derek Bell says, that directly confronting the scary things in life, as he said, let me both acknowledge my fear and move through it to an appropriate action. And quite topical, in Israel 22 years ago, 50 officers and soldiers in the Israeli army said they refused to serve in the West Bank and Gaza, and that the price of occupation was the loss of that army's semblance of humanity and the corruption of all Israeli society. They said they would no longer fight beyond the green line with the aim of dominating, expelling, starving, and humiliating an entire people. As Derek Bell puts it, these soldiers and officers manifested the courage of their convictions, placing conscience over military orders, a court-martial offence. A similarly supposedly law-breaking action, although probably no more than a gesture, came from an acquaintance, a Mennonite, who subtracted from his tax returns the equivalent percentage of what we spend on defence. This was a pointed action, but I think as we spend so little on defence, I think the revenue authorities probably ignored him. But the actions of this then young man, the soldiers, and the plowshare women indicate a willingness to see and act on a moral horizon beyond the law, as indeed does the behavior of Enoch Burke and of many of the protagonists who militantly oppose abortion provision. Derek Bell says he finds that people trying hard to lead ethical lives must draw on courage frequently, because standing up requires taking risks on a regular basis. In fact, he says, risk-taking is probably the most defining act of an ethical life. It also shows, I believe, a rugged honesty which is an essential ingredient of the ethical life, being indeed honest to God. Bell goes on to say that ethics requires us to think deeply about our positions on issues and take principled stands as a result of these positions. Principled stands, he says, will be tested regularly by society that valorizes external indications of success, such as money and corporate power, over much else. But let's go back a few hundred years to Thomas Hobbes and Immanuel Kant. For both, Susan Nyman tells us, the rule of law was vital. Civilization, she says, only begins when individuals concur in putting their competing wills into a framework that sets limits on all of them. But Hobbes and Kant soon part ways, because for Hobbes, Any legal framework is better than none, which is why we may shiver when we hear references to a Hobbesian society. For Hobbesians, the rule of law comes first. The rule of the absolute sovereign is the basis for all other rules of any kind. And the allegiance owed to him, as it always was, is absolute. Kant, however, believed that the framework must be right and grounded in ideas of justice prior to any rules. Ethics was primary. So, if we go with Kant, that ethics is primary, that our ethical base and our indeed our personal morals should not be subservient to the law, whether it be secular or religious, where do we get our ethical base? We need courage, as Bell says, to behave ethically. So let's posit a scenario, hypothetical, I hasten to add. Cigarettes, as we know them, definitively caused deaths in Ireland in 2015 of nearly 6,000 people. And one in two smokers will die from a tobacco-related disease. If there is a large, isolated cigarette factory, and I'm assured there is no risk to life or limb, either in the factory or locally, am I ethically, morally entitled to use the equivalent of a hammer and a strong arm to destroy it? Am I being honest to God? Ethical, perhaps, although the law is being broken. Or indeed, is the law being broken if I am reducing the likelihood of people dying from tobacco use? So, where do we get our ethics? Let's just look very briefly at a few moral ethical dilemmas, not necessarily with answers, and some philosophies which may or may not deal with them. Euthanasia. David Robertson and Chris Garrett pose a few questions. Would you like to be treated by a doctor who you knew had killed some of his patients out of kindness? Or how would you feel if you knew that the doctors in a hospital would never agree to give you euthanasia, even though you were in intense, severe pain? If ever there was a subject which indicates that we can never achieve ethical certainty, as this book says, but that we can become more morally aware, I think this is it. Ralph Halvorsen, which we've often quoted in this church, talks about truth. Truth, he says, may have been established, but it is not therefore above criticism and debate and growth. So too, I'd suggest moral ethical truths. It is moral ethical truths are subject to continual growth, continual fulfillment. And then we may decide that we'd like to be moral relativists. Somebody who believes that objective truth does not exist, that all truths depend on opinion. Subjectivism, saying morality is relative to the opinion of a particular person, and conventionalism, that it is relative to the opinion of a group. Or we might prefer the stance of Richard Holloway, who has been quoted in this church before. For him, the morality of an act, and here he is talking about sexuality, relies on whether it harms people, our interests, violates their rights, or causes injustice. And he writes, just because the link between religion and ethics has been broken, I'm not too sure about that, it does not follow that we can't have ethics. So we must discover the importance, he says, of a non religious ethic. He says, and this came up in our second reading, that what many people have clearly departed from is any sense that the moral life lived intentionally and consciously is consistent with bland obedience to authority, including what is alleged to be divine authority. The difficulty, he says, is not with obeying what is genuinely known to be a divine command. It is the fact that history has taught us that so many claims on behalf of God have been subsequently rejected for moral reasons. To understand our ethical base too, we might listen to Oren Harman, and he writes about altruism, which he says is by any standard a defining characteristic of ethical behavior. He poses the question, where do we get our altruism feelings? Is it in fact something that is biological? And then goes on to write that there may be no human behavior, strictly speaking, that is without a genetic component, but, and quoting, that's a world away from saying that our genes determine who we are and what we choose. Or we may like to be a pragmatist. Julian Baggini talks about how the meaning of beliefs are to be understood not in abstract terms or ideas or the inner workings of the mind, but by the practical differences they make. And then, perhaps which will appeal to most of us, situation ethics. Peter Vardy and Paul Grosch write that adherents of situation ethics say there is no such thing as conscience, which should guide human action, at least if conscience stands for intuition or God in some way speaking to human beings. Conscience, he says, is simply the term used for attempts to make decisions appropriately according to the situation. And quoting again, situation ethics holds that nothing is good in itself except for love. Actions are good if they help human beings, and they are bad if they hurt people. There is no other criterion. Vardy and Grosch write that faced with the problem that the law may condemn something done from love, we can simply say that no actions are intrinsically wrong in themselves. Jesus and Paul replaced the Torah, the strict Jewish law, with the principle of love. Even the Ten Commandments are not absolute. For example, Bonhoeffer, in his book Ethics, considered the command against killing to be absolute, rejecting euthanasia. Yet he was accused of trying to kill Hitler and executed. So far we've heard a very varying number of ethical views, that we can never achieve ethical certainty, that objective moral ethical truth does not exist, that the morality of an act relies on whether it causes harm, that there may be something in our genes which determines our actions, even partly, that the practical difference an action makes is what is important and not abstract ideas, and that no action is good in and of itself except for love. And concluding, as we contemplate current and pending wars, it might be opportune to glance at what we could do ethically if attacked. John Yoder writes that it's often asked of pacifists whether they would sit back and allow a loved one to be attacked. But Yoder distinguishes between the individual threat and war. Even Gandhi and Thomas Merton were ready without embarrassment to acknowledge the legitimacy of the violent defense of one's immediate family or self without seeing that as any compromise in their rejection of all organized violence in social or national causes. If I killed a person menacing my family, escalation is relatively unlikely. But in a war, and recent events have shown this, escalation is practically unavoidable. Yoder says, there has never been a major war which does not take on greater dimensions of destructiveness as it continued than were projected by those who began it. War, indeed, might have to be the focus of our ethical thinking. And situation ethics might be the appropriate framework to address the issues, if, of course, we decide to circumvent the laws which we believe are unethical. If we believe, like Bishop Robinson, that love alone is able to embrace an ethic of radical responsiveness, meeting every situation on its own merits, and that, as Yoder writes, people should honestly evaluate a war which a given government is waging or wishes to wage, then occasionally, he says, they might reject the war, not on the grounds of general pacifism, but because it's not an acceptable political undertaking for someone who does not reject all killing. Such decisions are and will be faced by many people around the world. Hopefully not ourselves. The hope for peace, perhaps, is that their decisions are based on ethics and not on merely on any law requiring them to partake in a war. Amen, and thank you. Sorry. Now our next hymn is number 123, and it's Spirit of Life. Thanks, Josh. Tea and coffee are served down there downstairs. If you're a visitor, you're, needless to say, particularly welcome. There are copies of Uskult magazine for October on the table outside. Please take one. Pam's Wednesday lunchtime reflection in the church and via the web camera will be on Wednesday afternoon about 1 o'clock. Thank you, everybody who helped at the service. The wonderful music by Josh. Ayla, who had the church looking sparkling. Trish, who did the reading. Paula and Andrew, who are being welcomers. Monica Cremens, Monica, for doing the flowers. And then coffee downstairs. There's crack team downstairs. Chris, Malky, and Kay are doing the coffee and the tea. The other thing, you've seen in Uskult, there is a plaintive plea from a man called John Darcy, and they were members of the church, are members of the church, and they're looking for accommodation in Dublin. And his wife, Susan, has Alzheimer's disease. So if you'd look at the website, Uskult, you'll see their message. The other two things are, on our next walk, these are organized by Marcus and Frank. Our next walk is on the 26th of October to Newbridge House, and we meet up at 10:30 at the Coach House Cafe. The book club meetings take place on the last Wednesday of every month. And we're having a different kind of harvest Thanksgiving on Sunday, the 20th of October. If anybody would like to cooperate and help with that, if they would contact Bridget, we're going to have food and lunch, and it's an aid of Christian aid. So our last hymn is Earth Was Given as a Garden, and it's number 207.
Let us leave this sacred space with warm feelings for the members of this congregation and for other Unitarian congregations, and we should definitely include Cork, who have suffered an enormous blow with the burning of their church, remembering that we are all, despite our flaws, trying to live up to our aspiration that love is the doctrine of this church. And until we meet again, may the road rise before you. May the sun be always at your back. And may God hold you and yours in the palm of his hand. Amen.